from the nation's capital. This is DC Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. Ladies and gentlemen, we have an extraordinarily interesting program today. The transition from jail project, something funded by the National Institute of Corrections, and our folks from the Urban Institute are back at the microphone. We have Jesse Janetta, who's been before our microphones before, been on our television show. He is a senior research associate with the Urban Institute, and Janine Buck, again, a senior research associate, again, with the Urban Institute, www.urban.org. This particular program has its own website, www.jailtransition.com, www.jailtransition.com. What I want to do before turning the microphones over to Janine and to Jesse is to read a one-paragraph description of this project, and then we talk about this whole concept of reentry from jail systems. This is from their executive summary. In 2007, the National Institute of Corrections partnered with the Urban Institute to develop and test an innovative, comprehensive model for effective jail-to-community transition, designed to address the unique challenges and opportunities surrounding jail reentry. The Transition from Jail Community Initiative advances systems-level change through collaborative and coordinated relationships between jails and local communities to address reentry, enhance public safety, reduced recidivism, and improved individual reintegration outcomes are the overarching goals of the model. And the other fact that I want to do before turning it over to my guest, 9 million people are released from jail systems every year versus 700,000 from state prisons. Again, Janine Buck and Jesse Janetta from the Urban Institute, welcome to DC Public Safety.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here today, Len.
All right. This is just an extraordinarily interesting program because I've had discussions with staff members, and you know they tell me, and from my own experience, there's nothing tougher than a jail. Mm-hmm. It is extraordinarily difficult to run an urban jail. It is chaotic. It is noisy. It is just loud. And if it has a booking center attached to it, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people processing in and out of this chaotic atmosphere every single day. How in the name of heavens do we plan on doing a reentry program within an atmosphere of a large urban jail? Who wants to take that?
I can start, Len. I think that, you know, really what you're describing is one of the fundamental challenges that the TJC model and project is trying to address is just how quickly the jail population turns over. Everyone goes to jail. That's where you go if it's a booking facility after you're arrested. So you have people who are in there, bonding out or being released in pretrial status pretty quickly. You have people who are there awaiting trial if they haven't been able to make bond or if they're not going to be released. You have people who are sentenced. You have parole probation violators. So it's a very diverse population coming in and out often pretty quickly. And so what TJC is trying to do, among other things, is to help jurisdictions think in a data-driven way about who they're looking for to intervene with in terms of how likely they are to reoffend, in terms of the needs that they have, so that they can take whatever resources that they have and target it where it's going to have the biggest positive impact on their local community. And so they're not, you know, trying to deal with the whole haystack, so to speak, but they're really looking for the needle.
All right, a yes or no question. Can this be done within this very chaotic? I mean, you've done the research and you had jurisdictions where you tried this. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously it can be done, but you know, the average person sitting out there who knows corrections and saying, no, this can't be done. It can be done, Janine.
It can be done. And in fact, it was done. We started our work and partnership with the National Institute of Corrections, as you mentioned, in 2007. Our first task was really to work with NIC and a large group of external advisors that drew from jail administrators, community-based service providers, local law enforcement, a whole host of folks who were very familiar with this issue, if not on the front lines of this issue, to devise a flexible and comprehensive model for jail transition, and then to go out and actually test that model
right
in the real-world setting of six communities. So we started with six communities in 2008. We started working first with Denver, the mm-hmm. city and county of Denver, which was a more urban
right.
jail setting, as you mentioned.
Right.
And then we also worked with a smaller, more rural county, Douglas County, mm-hmm. in Kansas, which is a much smaller jail.
Sure.
We started working there to implement the model, and we expanded to four additional sites the following year in 2009. Mm-hmm. Working with one of the largest jail systems, Orange County, bringing them on in 2009.
Orange County, California.
California, yes. Okay. And as well as a number of other sites, again, that were diverse with right. respect to size, structure of their system. And we found that, yes, they were able to implement the model.
What are the key elements of this model?
Well, I think first and foremost, and I think Jesse would agree with this, it's really collaboration. It is a systems approach that requires, like reentry does, working across systems. So it's the jail and the community and other members of the criminal justice system as well coming together to really jointly own this issue and work together collaboratively to create a model that works for them.
Is the whole idea exposing or attaching people caught up in the criminal justice system to services on the outside? Is that the heart and soul of it?
I think it's both, because what you want to do is have a process that starts in the jail. And again, you have often pretty short periods of intervention or unpredictable as well.
Yes.
You know, people may be with you in the jail for a while, but you may not know that at the outset of their time there. But even if it's just doing in-reach from community-based organizations into the jail to start meeting and identifying potential clients, you want a piece of it to begin pre-release if at all possible. And the other fundamental, I would say, is what we call the triage approach, so that you're trying through data, doing a pretty, you know, minimal in terms of resource risk to reoffend screener at booking, mm-hmm. So that you can see particularly who your higher risk portion of your population is. That's who you want to target first and foremost for programming. And at the same time, who are the people who are lower risk, who you want to keep into a more minimal intervention track? So again, right. you're really focusing the resources that you have and the time and energy that you have, which are limited, on the people who need it the most and that the community needs to get it the most.
Okay, so you're talking about the three categories of people who come into the jail system: those who are booked, those people who are there on a pretrial basis, and those people there serving short sentences. You're talking about all three populations.
Right. And I think that, you know, jurisdictions have come down that we've worked with in different ways on that. Some have preferred to work only with the sentence population. Others
right.
have said if they're in the right risk category and if they have the identified needs, we'll start working with them regardless of whether they're there on pretrial or sentence status. Because many people, you know, if they're in the jails for a substantial period of pretrial, if and when they are sentenced, they may be sentenced to time served. So if
right.
you've been in the jail for 3 months
right.
awaiting
not unusual.
The completion of your adjudication, you may then be sentenced. The judge will say, well, the 3 months you've been in jail already is sufficient to be the sentence. And so if you wait to work with them, you will have missed your window of opportunity for intervention.
Technical assistance was provided to the jails?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And what sort of technical assistance?
Well, we went in and helped first really get a handle on the jail population mm-hmm. that was there. Again, working this angle of a data-driven approach. Who's in your jail? How long are they there for? What kind of information do you have about your jail population? Again, I think bringing evidence-based practice or best practice to bear and providing technical assistance around that. So, as Jesse mentioned, having a universal screener for risk of reoffense,
right.
which is, allows you to get a very quick sort on your jail population,
okay.
which really drives that next approach, thinking about where do you put your resources, who should go on for in-depth a risk needs assessment to help drive decision-making around services that need to be received. So we provided technical assistance around both kind of reentry practices with respect to screening and assessment and looking at programming, evidence-based programs, as well as evaluation-related technical assistance.
All right, so we're talking about collaboration. We're talking about getting everybody together, figuring out what's in the community, how can those community resources be brought to the attention of people who are in the jail system, in the three categories of the jail system, providing technical assistance, making sure that they know what they're doing, using objective risk instruments, triaging people to ferret out the people who don't need services to those people who desperately need services. And I'm assuming afterwards, after you do all that, there's some sort of connection between that individual and services in the community upon release.
That's right. And I think the case planning is a key piece of that. So what you want to do through your triage process, so first you find your high-risk folks through the screener, and then out of that group, and often looking at people who are going to be in the jail for at least long enough to begin an intervention continuum. Those are the people who would get a full risk needs assessment to tell you what they need. And then that's got to be tied into the case plan so that you're taking, this is what we know about, what we need to address to reduce their likelihood of recidivism. And these are our goals. This is who we're trying to connect them to, both the programming in the jail and then in the community. Something we did a lot of work on in the participating communities is talking about and trying to have continuity of approach between the way the programming is delivered in the jail and in the community. So as you're addressing substance abuse, for example, which is a common issue in this population, are the in-jail programs and then the people providing that programming in the community that you're trying to hand people off to, are they doing this kind of work in the same way, or are they even really aware of how each of those pieces of the system is addressing it? Because if you hand somebody off from a substance abuse program in the jail that's doing things in one way, and then they go into the community, it's a completely different modality and philosophy, that can be really counterproductive, you know, particularly with the client who may feel like, well, you know, I don't know who to listen to. I'm getting different messages. Whereas if you can integrate that, then what you can try and do is build on a common approach and have them be mutually reinforcing.
Okay. I'm going to put on my – oh, go ahead.
And I would just add to that, I think another key piece was even developing that shared knowledge and understanding around screening and assessment and using, to the extent that you could, a shared instrument so that there was that continuity of understanding around needs.
Everybody's singing from the same sheet of music.
Exactly.
Right.
And you build a common vocabulary that makes sense.
I'm going to put on my practitioner hat. And you dealt with these individuals as how many jurisdictions, Janine?
Currently, altogether right now, we will have been working with 14. We worked with six in the first round.
And that's a lot of jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. All right. I would imagine the average person sitting at that table at the very beginning is saying, pardon my sexism, lady, don't you understand how difficult it is to run a jail? We've got to do this and that, and it's going through their minds. A dozen issues are going through their minds. Do we really have the time to do this, and is this really going to be successful? There had to be a certain level of cynicism on the part of hard-bitten criminal justice administrators when this issue was first brought up.
I would say that, although one thing to bear in mind is we had a competitive application process for the opportunity to be in TJC sites. So we are working with jurisdictions that
want you there,
put their foot forward. But with that said, particularly when you're talking about a large collaborative endeavor, the jurisdiction or the person who wrote the application for the jurisdiction may feel that way. But there's a real diversity of opinion, you know, within everybody in that jurisdiction about how feasible it was. And we have had to deal with that, as well as, you know, we started with two sites in 08, another four in 09, working with them in phase one through the middle of the financial crisis when, you know, spending of all kinds and resources of all kinds in local government have really been in retrenchment. And that did bring skepticism. But I think that one of the things that was really heartening in what we found in phase one is the degree to which our local partners said, no, that's these budget cuts. And some of our participating jurisdictions experienced quite substantial budget cuts in some of the core, whether it was the sheriff's department or probation or the community providers. But that for them was not a reason not to do TJC, but was in fact a reason that the kind of strategic approach that we're doing, they felt, was as important as ever, because now our resources are even more limited. And it's all the more important that we are making sure we're using them in as targeted a way as possible. And they really hung in there through some tough times. You know, a lot of local jurisdictions, the degree to which there was already some degree of programming or connection to community resources, there's a lot of great stuff going on at the local level and a lot of jail reentry activity going on all around the country. So while there is that skepticism, we also had the opportunity through TJC, and this started when we brought together our network of jail practitioners at the beginning, to build on what everybody has been doing at the local level and learning already,
enhance it,
and put it together into a common approach. and then, you know, try and bring that out to the
field. Second question I want to get to right before the break, and that is this, is that a lot of, you know, I've been in this business for a long time. A lot of people at the community level don't particularly appreciate people caught up in the criminal justice system. They find them hard to deal with versus a very motivated person. This is the classic example from a drug treatment provider who a woman has three kids and she's strung out on cocaine and she desperately wants to get it off of it for her sake and her kids versus my guy on parole who or mandatory supervision who was forced into it by a judge or by the member of the parole commission. They say I'd much rather have the woman who wants to be there than the person who was forced to be there. So whether it was any resistance in terms of expanding the number of contacts through the jail systems?
I don't think there was resistance to that. I think people were on board with that. I do think having the information at their disposal about who to target, when and how much was very helpful, having that evidence-based approach both from the community and the jail side.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Jesse, what would you add?
Yeah, well, I also say if you're a community organization working on a lot of different social issues, it's a really open question, and part of the data-driven approach that we can do can, you know, illuminate this. Mm-hmm. How different is that really from what you're already doing? I mean, if you're a community organization working with people who have serious mental health issues in the community, you're working with a population
right.
that's in and out of jail. Same with addiction issues. People at the career centers, a lot of the folks who are coming in off the street who really need help mm-hmm. getting attached to employment have been criminal justice involved. So in many cases, you know, the fundamental insight is on the community side, whether you know it or not, you're already working with the population that's in and out of the jail. So why don't we collaborate so that that work can be more effective? I think that a lot of community mm-hmm. organizations, even if they're relatively new to this effort, found that that was the case, that they're not finding new people.
Right after the break, I do want to talk about some of the successes that you've had. I mean, there has to be many successes considering the amount of jurisdictions that you were in. But ladies and gentlemen, let me reintroduce both my guest and the program. We have Janine Buck, Senior Program Associate, and Jesse Janetta, again, Senior Research Associate, rather, from the Urban Institute, www.urban.org. The specific website for this project, the program, is called the Transition from Jail Project, www.jailtransition.com, www.jailtransition.com. Janine or Jesse, certainly you have your fair share of success stories from this. I mean, people are sitting there going, okay, now I get the concept, and now Leonard has defended us on terms of the practitioner community by these over-eager and over-optimistic researchers. But this is something that's necessary. This is, I mean, we've been talking about using jails as a triage facility and connecting them with community resources for years, but people have said we just don't have the resources to do that. So out of all the jurisdictions that you've been with and interacted with, give me some success stories.
I think really all of our jurisdictions have been success stories specifically with that.
Right.
You know, they had very committed networks of community-based partners and providers. Some obviously had much broader networks than others, but everybody really came to the table through this and were very committed. And I think to Jesse's point right before the break, it's important to note that many of the providers who were at the table knew these people, knew that their clients were a part of the jail population, had a stake in coming to the table, and I think they were excited mm-hmm. to be a part and invited to the table and to help, because they really were already owning
right.
this issue, but to work collaboratively in that way. That said, I think we saw in all of the jurisdictions that we were working in an expansion in terms of the network of community-based providers, community participation that was at the table, both at a systems level in terms of collaboration, but also in terms of the nuts and bolts coming to the table, doing in-reach, or being willing to change or modify their practice
right.
To have that continuity of approach. Jesse, what would you add?
I mean, the biggest thing that I would add is I think it's fair to say that when we started phase one, not one of those jurisdictions was really having validated risk and need information guiding who was getting programming services in the jail.
Which is crucial.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, sites reach different degrees to which that information was driving the process, but every one of them had it. Every one of it had it integrated in a process where it was, in fact, informing who was getting program services. So they were moving towards this point where they were confident or gaining confidence that now we are serving who we want to. You know, in most jurisdictions that we've worked with, if you ask who determines who gets programming in the jail, the answer number one is usually the inmates.
Right.
It's their volition. And so, and often it's the judges for some of the mandated programming. Mm-hmm. And what they wanted to do is say, no, we as a system have to say who ought to be in that programming. And then, you know, there's challenges convincing the inmates to do it, or sometimes, you know, if you have to go back to the bench to get them to be on board with that strategy. But if you can't even say who's supposed to be getting the program, right, you can never get there strategically. And they got there, I think.
Help me with my misunderstanding. Is this solely an in-house program, or is it a connection to the community program, or both?
I would say both, and I think it may be, you know, easiest to give some examples. A good one, I think, is in the city and county of Denver. So what they did is do a lot of work on enhancing their continuum between the jail life skills program that they have, where their jail program officers were doing programming of a lot of different kinds. And then they had community capacity through what was called the Community Reentry Project. Mm-hmm. And the primary handoff they were trying to do is get people to go to the Community Reentry Project, which had capacity to do a lot of different kind of services there or refer out. And I kind of think of that as the hub and spoke. So they were trying to identify who were the priorities to get programming in the jail, get them in jail life skills, have them meet initially with staff from the Community Reentry Project prior to release, and then get them to go there where a lot of things that they needed could be handled there at CRP, or they could refer out. But that was the primary door they wanted people to go through in the community.
And was there meaningful success in terms of hooking people into programs? I mean, once you figured out, in terms of your objective risk instrument, who needed services and who didn't. I mean, and anybody who's been on the floor of a booking center, right, or the floor of an intake area of a jail, it's pretty obvious who needs psychiatric treatment as they walk in through the door, who's withdrawing from drugs as they're walking in through the door. We know that many offenders commit their crimes while under the influence of some substance. It's pretty easy to understand that this is a population in dire need. So considering that the dire need of that population, do you feel that the jurisdictions really succeeded in terms of hooking the right people up with the right services?
Yeah, I think that they did. Is there room to grow? I'm sure there is. But I think over the life of the technical assistance period, we really saw a movement toward that in each jurisdiction. Jurisdictions implemented cognitive-based restructuring programs, were used that risk and assessment information to really link the right individuals to those services.
Okay, for a thinking for a change, teaching people how to make good judgments throughout life, yes.
Right, exactly. Kind of a foundational piece to thinking about change.
Right.
How you're looking at your circumstances. And moving them and using that kind of as a foundation for linking them and building that continuum of other services. So, I mean, to answer your question, I think they did. Again, I think we saw substantial movement there. We're doing a sustainability assessment in the six sites, going back to look and see what's been sustained since the technical assistance period ended.
Right.
How are they building on things? And we're seeing in the jurisdictions that we were working in, they've kept the screening and assessment procedures. They're still using them. They're thinking very strategically about who to target for programming, and they're continuing to build their continuum of programs and thinking very much about risk and need and who to put there. And so I think we saw movement there. I think it's something that will continue to
expand. So in all the jurisdictions that you work with from a technical assistance point of view, they embrace this, they embraced it seriously, and more people are being plugged into more programs. And more importantly, the right people are being plugged into the right programs.
I think yes, and I think there are...
That's extraordinary.
And in programming that in many places didn't exist. I mean, we had several that didn't have any cognitive-based programming were able to implement Thinking for a Change. Several put in programming units in their jail facilities so that the people living living in that housing unit were all people who were in the target population for programming, and the programming was delivered there, which wasn't happening. I mean, they didn't have the screening and assessment information. And the other thing, although this was in some ways the biggest TA challenge, making a lot of progress in having an ability to measure, to do performance measurement around their transition processes. You know, there are huge limitations in the data systems locally, so they know that data-driven processes are the way to go. They know that these things they're doing are important to measure, but it's very hard to do it. Some of that is about the data systems they have. I often think a bigger limiting factor is the number of trained staff who know how to pull that information, analytical capacity in the counties. There may only be a few people who know it, mm-hmm. and there are huge claims, you know, that those skills are very valuable, and often the people who know how to do that are shared not only with the jail or the justice system, but with the entire county. So it's challenging to get to get down into the data and know what's going on, but really valuable.
We only have about 4 minutes left. What message would you give to other correctional administrators throughout this country that run jails? Again, the numbers are enormous compared to those released from prisons. 700,000 come out of state and federal prisons every year versus 9 million coming out of the jail systems. So to the jail administrators, correctional administrators that you're talking to, mayors, governors, aides to mayors and governors, what message would you give to them as a result of your experience as part of this National Institute of Corrections funded project?
There are tremendous resources already going to the population mm-hmm. that is going in and out of the jails, but often not in a very coordinated or coherent way.
Okay.
Most jurisdictions, without getting a dime of additional resources, can be more effective in working with that population if they use something like the TJC model to be more strategic. And to the community partners, people who are not criminal justice system or don't work in jails, most people coming out of jails aren't under probation supervision. They walk out of the jail with no necessarily formal responsibility right. to anyone in the criminal justice system. So for jail transition to work, other community partners have to step up to the plate and be willing as full partners to work with those folks coming back from the jail. And people in the criminal justice system, for this to really work, have to be willing to invite in the community partners and let them participate as okay. full partners. Otherwise, you're going to be really limited in what you're able to do.
And go ahead, Jeanette.
And I was just say, and to add to that, I think, you know, part of collaboration and inviting people in, too, is being willing to share information back and forth about practice. I think, again, speaking to that, the importance of that data-driven piece to being able to measure what you're doing and not just the outcome of is it effective, but do you have data? Are you willing to share that information to see that you are serving the right people, that you're serving them in a timely fashion, that you're addressing their needs, and being open to looking at the data, I think, to use that to make system improvements, which was a key part of the TJC model, too.
And I would imagine the strength of all of this is a team approach in terms of working with these individuals sure. caught up in the criminal justice system.
Absolutely.
So it's just not the Salvation Army. It's just not
right.
mental health people. It's just not substance abuse people. It's just not people helping women with children or
right.
people with HIV. It is supposedly, I'm assuming, a comprehensive approach of trying to bring as many partners to the table as to this one person as humanly possible. Which gets us the biggest bang possible bang for our dollar, correct?
Right. That's absolutely right. And jurisdictions did that in different ways. The jurisdictions that we worked with in Kent County, they really brought everybody together. They had a strong community base there, had substance abuse providers, mental health providers working with correctional officers in the jail,
mm-hmm.
really at a team approach from not just a coordinated case plan, but coming to the table together and discussing cases together.
There is hope. What you're telling me is that from years of experience funding by the National Institute of Corrections, a research technical assistance project from the Urban Institute, there is hope. People listening to this and saying, there's no way I can do it in my chaotic jail. What we're saying is that you can.
Right.
Right.
And there are tools available.
Yeah. You know, we've had the opportunity, as we've said, to work with 14 jurisdictions. There are 2,800 jail systems in the United States. NIC knew that our impact would be really limited in only the 14. So the model is deep dive in these 14 different places. capture everything that we're learning, make it available to everyone else. The project website is the place to go for that. If we've done what we're supposed to do, what you need is there.
Okay, Jesse Janetta, you've got the final word, ladies and gentlemen. The program today is the Transition from Jail Project, funded by the National Institute of Corrections. Our guests today have been Janine Buck, Senior Research Associate, and Jesse Janetta, again, Senior Research Associate from the Urban Institute, www.urban.org. The website for this program is www.jailtransition.com, www.jailtransition.com. Ladies and gentlemen, this is D.C. Public Safety. We appreciate your comments. We even appreciate your criticisms, and we want everybody to have themselves a very pleasant day.